For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thanks, everyone, for showing up tonight. My name is Matt Vogel. I've been around Ancient Dragon for around 10 years or so. I am the Eno, so that means I help take care of the temple and make practice, make practice as easy as possible and support people in their practice as I can. And the talk I'm going to give tonight, I am not an expert in Chinese poetry or in a lot of these things, but I just wanted to share some things that I've been working with in my practice over the past couple months. And yeah, I'll get started. So I was walking through my neighborhood the other day, and I noticed some of these signs that the high school and college students have put up, like that are graduating, and it's 2020. And I remembered at the beginning in December, there was a lot of talk about how 2020 was like the year of seeing clearly, like 2020 vision. And I was like, wow, we're seeing a lot of things really clearly right now. And on the other hand, things are so unclear too. So I was really thinking like, wow, this is like a really interesting time. I shouldn't even say that. That's like cliche to say that now. I'm going to share my screen. And I thought this helped capture kind of how I've been feeling. Let's see here. Here we go. So it's a cartoon, and there's a man sitting in bed with his phone, and his partner says, "Go to sleep. Everything will be worse in the morning." And I kind of feel like I wake up in the morning after a night of sleep and feeling a little bit like that, like, oh wow, you know, like what's happening? What's going to happen next? And I think a lot of people now have this same kind of fear pretty much every day, all the time. Even if we're not noticing it, it's always there, this uncertainty of what's going to happen. And I think there's always been this uncertainty. There's always things that are going on, but it's sort of like this mass, everyone is feeling it at the same time. And you know, there's over 150,000 people that have died from the coronavirus in the United States. And there's like not really any clear leadership right now. I mean, that's fearful. And yet there's also, you know, we're seeing more people seeing racism clearly for the first time. Like some anti-racism books are the top sellers now. And that's a positive, I think, of the way we're going. We see clearly how much we rely on our healthcare workers, on the people who bring us food, who service us. And a lot of these are disproportionately from minority communities too. And so we're seeing clearly how much they support us just in living. And this whole time, it's also about the importance of Sangha and community. You know, Dogen emphasizes that Zazen is a community practice, that we practice it together. And, you know, we're social animals. We need to connect with other people. There's a lot of studies that show connecting with others benefits our mental and physical well-being. The shame that people feel around loneliness is kind of like being disconnected with it's a little bit of a protection device for us to like connect with others. But on the other hand, we're practicing, a lot of us, sheltering at home completely alone. Or in my case, you know, I have my wife and my daughter, and we don't see a lot of people really outside of that. In April, I listened to a talk that Norman Fisher gave where he compared to what we're doing right now. He compared it to hermit practice. Hermits who go off into the mountains or into the forest or into the woods, and they practice there. And I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it. And because I think part of my thing about hermits a little bit has been like, well, aren't they just selfish leaving the world? They're going to go off into these mountain retreats and practice and, you know, near this babbling brook, and the rest of us are trying to just get by around here. But going into this talk and like thinking about my own, like, I don't really have any personal experience with hermits, but I have a lot of experience with poems about hermits. So I wondered, like, So what about when we can't practice with others, when we have to be secluded from others? How do we practice with all beings as we're secluded in our home, houses, and apartments? How can we have that still that sense of connection and practice with others? So I did a little basic research on hermits, and I found that in India, you know, going out into the forest was a thing that hermits did because they would go into these wild, uninhabited places outside of conventional culture to escape conventional culture. And there were demons there and criminals, exiles, other spiritual seekers. And what was interesting what helped them, I think, was that there were no rules, there are no authorities, and it was just the chaos and the rules of the forest. And this helped them step away from, like as Paul Disco was talking about in his talk yesterday, to really step away from these mass delusions that we have in human culture. And some of these are important, of course, but they wanted to just step away from that and see, get in touch with something more primordial, get in touch with that source. And in China, there's a very, very long history of hermits as well. And I read a book, it's called Road to Heaven by Bill Porter. He's also known as Red Pine. He's a translator. And he wondered in the 90s, he wondered, were there any of these hermits left after the Cultural Revolution? And I hope I'm not going to spoil this for anyone, but he found that there were still hermits living, maybe not as much as there once were, but they were still this tradition, especially in this one mountain range. And I'll just read a little part of his introduction about hermits. He says, throughout Chinese history, there have always been people who prefer to spend their lives in the mountains, getting by on less, sleeping under thatch, wearing old clothes, working the higher slopes, not talking much, writing even less, maybe a few poems, a recipe or two. Out of touch with the times, but not with the seasons, they cultivated roots of the spirit, trading flatland dust for mountain mist. Distant and insignificant, they were the most respected men and women in the world's oldest society. And then he says, why has this lasted so long? And he says, it's lasted because the Chinese have always esteemed the past, and hermits preserve the most essential element of the past, its spiritual tradition. He also talked in an interview with Tricycle. He says, it's one of the hermit tradition is one of the most important parts of Chinese society. We in the West almost always think of hermits as misanthropes, as people who want to step out of, kind of like I was saying, aren't they just these selfish people, and have nothing to do with society. Whereas in China, the hermit has always been seeking the wisdom with which to guide society. My conversations with hermits in China led me to conclude that for them, seclusion was like going to graduate school. Afterwards, they can teach. There was an awareness that to bring the teachings they had learned to fruition, individuals needed to be alone with them. They're like a mountain stream that brings fresh water down into town. The water eventually reaches the town, no matter whether you pipe it down or it comes down as a spring. So thinking about these hermits from this hermit tradition from China, that it also comes down to us through Zen Buddhism, of course. I went back into some poetry that I've been, and some of these poems I've been reading for almost 20 years now, and some of them are new to me. But I found that after listening to that talk and reading this book, reading these poems really helped me work with some of the uncertainty that is going on, some of the fear and some of those very strong emotions that are arising right now. And I'm going to say right now, each of these poems, probably someone could do a talk just on one of these poems. They're very rich. So I'm just going to, it's very much reading them and introducing them. And I'll put them in the chat later if you want to like take a look at them later as well. So the first poem I'd like to show you is one that Tigan actually shared with me when I first came to Ancient Dragon as Zazen instruction. So here is the poem. It's by Wang Wei. He lived in the 700s, and he was a politician, He was an artist, he was a musician, and he was also this very famous poet as well. So here's the poem. In my middle years, I have grown fond of the way. I head out from my hut on South Mountain to look for sights only I can see. I follow the stream back to the source and sit and wait for the time when clouds arrive. Perhaps I meet a woodsman. We talk and laugh, and I forget to go home. So Tygen, this is a very short poem. Tygen shared it with me probably about 10 years ago. But I come back to this poem all the time. It's very rich. And especially this instruction of following the stream back to the source. And I really like this, and sit and wait for the time when clouds arrive. I love the nature images that these poems will use to talk about zazen, to talk about life, and like going back to the source. I can imagine like going up this next to the stream and following it and sitting. And I think of the clouds, waiting for the clouds to arrive, as like, could be our thoughts, it could be feelings, it could be a new situation that's happening, and how just like a cloud, they sort of move through the sky and we can't really grab onto them. We can't push them away, but they're these, if you look at them in the right way, they're these beautiful like sculptures that are constantly moving. And so I think of that a lot in my zazen when I practice. And I also think about it when I'm having some difficult times too, thinking like, oh, this is a cloud that's passing right now. I also like the part about that he meets the woodsman and talks. He's not like, oh, I'm practicing, I'm very important, I'm going to go down and go sit in zazen right now. He's like, oh, he talks with this woodsman, he connects with him. And I love that he forgets to go home. I don't know, there's something about that. I am still working with that, but I love that he, you know, forgets to go home. Some of this also, this poem reminds me of, I'm also going to refer a couple of times to recommending zazen to all people, also known as the Fukan Zazengi, and by Dogen, our founder in Japan, from the 1200s. And this part here, this section here, stop searching for phrases and chasing after words. Take the backward step and turn the light inward. Your body mind of itself will drop away and your original face will appear. If you want to attain this, immediately practice just this. And for me, the line, take the backward step and turn the light inward, is just also one of these very short, very simple, but very powerful practice instructions. I always think of like, we're all, as human beings, we're always like moving forward, trying to get forward, and taking a backward step is very radical in a way. It's like we're taking a step back and just like kind of like sitting and seeing what's going to happen. We're not moving forward with what we need to do next, what we need to accomplish next. And this turning the light inward, it's kind of echoes what we chanted earlier from Song of the Grass Hut, of turning around the light to shine within and then just return. So that's echoed there too. And I think of this turning this light as I don't know if you're familiar with Tara Brach, she's a Vipassana teacher, but she talks about waking up from our trances. So like the trance that we have when we narrowly focus in on something and we can break free from that trance sometimes. And I think that's what this turning this light and taking this backward step is about, is breaking these trances sometimes that difficult emotions can put us in. And I also, like over the past couple of months, I realized that I've taken this turning the light almost like this floodlight that's like really showing everything. And I think that maybe we have been a little bit too harsh and it's a little self-critical as well. And it was sort of like, oh, I want to see what's there so I can get rid of it. Like whatever's difficult, I want to get rid of it. And I think now this light, I'm starting to think of it more as shining this light the way you would hold a baby, and you need to give it just a little bit of room to move, you know, like a little bit of room, like kind of that gentle kindness that you have. Or maybe like holding like a toad, you know, you catch a toad in the middle of a road and you hold it in your hands and you can feel it kind of moving, like that kind of turning the light that's what turning the light is meaning more for me. And just watching that toad for a while until, you know, it hops away and it goes away. It's kind of like letting these things be before you let them go. I think I'm always trying to just let them go. And it's like, maybe I just need to let them be and be with them for a little bit. Then we just chanted Song of the Grass Hut. And this is like probably every two lines could be its own Dharma talk in this. And there's a great book by Ben Connolly. He actually goes through each couplet there and describes them all. I'm just going to highlight a couple of lines that I've been working with, especially now. I think when we first had this stay at home order, I was trying to figure out, okay, how can I create this container for my practice? I think that's kind of what this poem is about. It's like, how do you create your practice? How do you have this hut, this container for where you're going to practice? And I kind of treated like the first couple of weeks almost like a sesshin. I was like, okay, I'm going to wake up at this time. I'm going to have a schedule. I'm going to eat my meals, you know, like, and say the verses. And I mean, that was fine, but then it was also maybe a little bit too intense. And so I really love this line, after eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. I think that's just wonderful self-care. Sometimes it's like, we don't always have to be in a sesshin. It's like these hermits practiced all the time, but they knew how to follow the needs of their bodies. Like they knew how to move with nature. And so I think just like relaxing and enjoying a nap sometime is perfectly fine. We don't have to be on, you know, 100% all the time. And I love this, this idea of, you know, when it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. And now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. And, you know, again, like I was saying earlier, usually the weeds are the things that we're trying to get rid of, right? We want to pull them out of our garden. But here, the weeds are incorporated into this hut, into this practice, into this container, so that, and it makes it probably even stronger. I don't know. I've never lived in a grass hut before, but I bet you that you probably want all the, everything you can to keep out the wind. The one thing I like about this is that it's in nature, you know, and I sometimes think, you know, wouldn't it be nice to just go off to this beautiful mountain retreat, go to a beautiful place like Green Gulch or Tassajara. Last summer I went to Hokyoji, which is in Minnesota. It's another retreat center in the Katagiri Roshi lineage. And it's this beautiful place. It, I think actually Paul Disco may have designed the Zendo in one of the buildings there. And it's just a nice Zendo. It's like, you know, that's where real practice happens, right? Out there. That's where I'm going to. And actually, I think for me, I think this is more, I'm going to show another cartoon here. This might be a little bit more describing what I think practice is like, I think. There's like a hermit with a long beard sitting with a loincloth kind of a thing. And there's a hiker who comes up behind him and he sees all this garbage just spread out. There's a pizza box, there's like underwear, toilet paper, a laptop, bottles. And he says, most people come up the other side of the mountain. And I think like, oh, the Shitu, he's probably sitting up on this mountain, you know, and like, or, you know, these guys are sitting up there and it's so peaceful and calm. And I don't think they actually had like all this garbage with them, but I think there's a lot of garbage and stuff that we bring with us when we go to retreat. I certainly did when I went to Hokyoji. I had to watch a lot of stuff that was painful, but it's also helpful to see it, you know, turning that light to shine within all of this stuff that we carry around with us all the times. And it's also for me anyway, like I'm not going to be able to go to one of these nice mountain retreats anytime soon and sit and do a sesshin. So my retreat center is, you know, or my, where I practice is in my own house with my dirty couch, you know, and my mess and clutter and my family. And so I think sometimes it's like this jade palaces and vermilion towers. I almost think of that as like, those are like the retreat centers for me. But for me, like the solitary window below the green pines is just my apartment right now. So another question I have, like we've been, you know, practicing, like you see all the garbage now, but what do you do when all this stuff comes up? When you see all this stuff coming up? Because I'm kind of making a joke about it, but it's been very difficult looking at the habits I have very closely, the unhealthy habits, I should say, just looking at like how I react with fear or anger, or sometimes it's just profound boredom. At times it's like, what am I going to do with myself? How am I going to distract myself? So this next poem I really liked, and this is from a collection called Daughters of Emptiness. And Florence Kaplow, actually, Tygen suggested that I write to her because all my poets that I had up until a couple of days ago were all men. I was like, I got to change that. That's not right. And so she suggested this book called Daughters of Emptiness. It's wonderful. It goes through several centuries of Chinese nuns who wrote poems. And it's really, you get this kind of nice, I haven't read the whole thing. I've just kind of skimmed it, but really interesting sense of how these nuns practice so many centuries ago, and yet they're so fresh. So here's a poem by Ben Ming. She died in 1141. We don't know that much about her, but she wrote some poems and she shared them with her teacher at the end of her life, and he ended up publishing them. They were, and I think they were in a collection somewhere still to this day. But here's her poem. Don't you know that afflictions are nothing more than wisdom? But to cling to your afflictions is nothing more than foolishness. As they rise and melt away again, you must remember this. The sparrowhawk flies through Sila without anyone noticing. So I love this line. Don't you know that afflictions are nothing more than wisdom? And I think of that garbage that hermit has, you know, like all this stuff. There's all this stuff that comes up. It's really wisdom. It's really, there's an intelligence there. And it's like, just like in the Fukan Zazengi, you know, turning that light to see this. And I didn't know this reference, but the sparrowhawk flies through Sila without anyone noticing. That was a reference to awakening can happen at any moment. And you have to watch out for it because you might miss it, just like the sparrowhawk flying through the forest. And so I think that goes really along well with, like, if you're looking at these afflictions, you might see this awakening might happening, this wisdom might happen, but you have to watch for it too. And this reminded me of another part of the Fukan Zazengi, where Dogen says, let go of involvements and let myriad things rest. Do not think good or bad. Do not judge right or wrong. Stop conscious endeavor and analytic introspection. Do not try to become a Buddha. How could being a Buddha be limited to sitting or not sitting? And the part I want to highlight here is definitely is this part of, like, don't think good or bad. Don't judge right or wrong. I know when I see all of these emotions come up, I am definitely thinking wrong and bad. It's like, this shouldn't be happening. I should be feeling better. There's something I need to do about this. And I think when he says stop conscious endeavor and analytic introspection, I don't think Dogen's saying stop thinking. I think he's saying, like, what I'm doing is, like, stop judging it all the time. Stop trying to analyze it all the time. Just be with whatever is happening right now. And again, it's not trying to get rid of these things. It's just letting them rest. She said, rising and melting away. It's kind of like those clouds from the Wang Wei poem. Like, things are rising and things are falling. Just let them rise and then melt away again. And just paying attention to them. and I think another thing that Tara Brach talks about, she's a psychologist, and she says that all difficult emotions at their heart have a positive intention. And we can come to appreciate their intelligence. So, for example, fear is a way to help to protect us from loss. Anger helps us remove obstacles. Depression, it protects us from the rawness of the pain that we feel. And so it's not that we're trying to get rid of these. It's like we're trying to say, hey, you know, where we can feel these things. These are nothing more than wisdom. Now, that doesn't mean like we should try not to like work on these, but a first step is just to be with them. And okay, I have one more cartoon to show you. This one says, Godzilla is sitting on a couch and he's looking a little frustrated and he says, Godzilla versus himself. And he says, I shouldn't stomp so much, but it's my nature. I'm Godzilla, not Bambi. And when I saw this cartoon in the New Yorker, I was thinking, like, this is kind of like what anger is like, or some of these emotions. It's like, you know, they stomp around. There's like, they're there to protect us. There's wisdom there. And we shouldn't treat them like Bambi either. We should be careful with them. But we should also let them be. And I think part of what I've, when working with these emotions and these difficult parts of the path is like, you know, meeting that edge where you feel that, but then softening with it. Kind of like I was saying, like holding that baby, softening with those difficult things, giving them some room, giving them some inner space to breathe a little bit. And then we can kind of step back and see them a little more clearly and actually appreciate them and not getting rid of them. And there's kind of a tenderness there too. And we hold them. We hold, like for me, like right now, especially fear. Like I wake up and I have there's fear every single morning. And I don't even know why necessarily. There's like a kind of feeling. And just like, there's a tenderness there too. When I take a step back and like, oh, okay, this is fear. And there's something going on here. And just like being with it. The next poet I'd like to talk about is, his name is Ryokan. And he is a Japanese poet, and he lived from 1758 to 1831. And he's kind of a national hero now in Japan. And he lived in, I have a little introduction. So in Kaz Tanahashi's book, he says, he wrote a book called Sky Above, Great Wind, and talks about his life and translates some of his poetry. And he says, Ryokan was a pilgrim, a hermit, and a beggar. He was one of the numberless spiritual practitioners who gave up secular life to practice humility in search of the highest truth. He was free from family, social obligations, possessions, good looks, status, and fame. After completing rigorous training in a monastery for 10 years, he disassociated himself from religious institutions. Enduring harsh weather, extreme poverty, sickness, and ridicule by others, Ryokan sustained his solitary Zen Buddhist practice in good humor. He composed poems that were lofty yet imaginative and fresh, and presented in gracefully dancing brushworks. Part of what Kaz Tanahashi likes about him is that he was this brilliant calligrapher as well. And so Ryokan lived on this mountain, or actually lived in a couple of places, but he spent a lot of time in this mountain in the snow country of Japan, where sometimes it snows 12 feet. And he would live in these abandoned temples and huts, and he subsisted completely on going through the villages and begging. And so he led this very solitary existence, but he also went out into the community and practiced with them and enjoyed them. And first of all, here's the first one I'll read to you. One narrow path surrounded by a dense forest. On all sides, mountains lie in darkness. The autumn leaves have already fallen. No rain, but still the rocks are dark with moss. Returning to my hermitage along a way known to few, carrying a basket of fresh mushrooms and a jar of pure water from the temple well. So a lot of his poems are like this. You get this really interesting glimpse into what his life was like. He's living in nature, you know, and he's all alone, but he's like really just like at one with everything that's around him. And like I said, he also though went into the villages and begged, and he liked to stop and talk with people, drink sake, play games with them. He especially loved playing with children. And here's two poems that he wrote. Shaggy hair past the ears, a worn out robe resembling white clouds and dark smoke. Half drunk, half sober, I return home. Children all around, guiding me along the way. So the children would see him coming, and they would know, oh, this is time to play. You know, he would have, I think they said he had like two or three balls in his sleeves that he would always be playing with them. And there's one story where he was playing, there's a lot of stories about him, like anecdotes about him that are very famous in Japan. And he was playing hide and seek with them, and he hid in a haystack. And so the children were looking for him for a long time, couldn't find him. And finally they got bored and went away. And the next morning the farmer came and was like trying to move the hay, and Ryokan, and he said, Ryokan, what are you doing in there? And he says, shh, the children will find me. And so, I don't know. He has a lot of kind of like funny stories like this And here's a poem about a grass war. Once again, the children and I are fighting a battle using spring grasses, now advancing, now retreating, each time with more refinement. Twilight, everyone has returned home. The bright round moon helps me endure the loneliness. I love these poems like that he writes, because you can really just, he's not afraid to like talk that, oh, he has this great time, but then he's also so lonely at times too. And another story about him is he didn't preach to people. He didn't reprimand them. He just sort of like mingled with people and just lived his life. And this was actually very inspiring for people around him. One time there was a family that he knew, and there was one of the sons was sort of like squandering the family money and was getting into a lot of trouble. And the mom said, please come and talk to my son. You know, I need you to help him. He needs to get out of this. And so Ryokan came over and they had dinner, and he didn't really end up talking to this son. And as he was leaving, the son bent down to tie his sandals, and he felt this wet water on the back of his neck. And he looked up and he saw that Ryokan was crying. And Ryokan didn't say anything. He left. But then this son changed his ways. He realized, oh man, I'm making this big mistake. And I really love this story because he didn't say anything. He just expressed his emotion. He expressed how he felt. He let those tears tell what he needed to say. And so I wish I could do that. I wish I could be like that, direct like that, and not have to like talk so much. Another poem here, listening to the evening rain in my hermitage. The great way, I braid spring flowers into a ball. The future, if a visitor brings these questions, I have only the tranquility of the hermitage to offer. So he had a lot of visitors come to see him, and he would welcome them. He didn't have very much. He had like a desk and a zafu and a place to sleep, and that was pretty much it. And one time a scholar came to visit him, and he saw him sitting in meditation, and he said, oh, I'm going to wait until he's done. So he waited there for, it says in the story, 3 hours. And finally, Ryokan said, oh, hello. And then they started talking about, I think probably, poetry or something for a while. And then Ryokan said, oh, let me get up. I'm going to go get some sake. And so he ran out. And so the scholar's sitting there waiting and waiting and waiting. He's like, where's Ryokan? Where is he going? He's starting to get upset. I'm like, where is he going? And so he's like, okay, I'm going to go find him. And he walked out and 100 feet from the temple where he was staying, Ryokan is looking up at the bright moon. And he said, Ryokan, what are you doing? He said, oh my gosh, I forgot about the sake. And he ran into town and got the sake and came back. And so there's all these great stories about him, like being absent-minded and forgetful, but also very kind and welcoming. There's a couple more poems I have too. When I was reading these, like, well, are we really hermits? Are we recluses? I mean, I don't think I am. I'm not here on, staying at home of my own choice. You know, I'm not in some mountain like place where I'm sitting alone for long periods of time. But I think there's a lot that I've been learning from reading these poems about their lives, about the courage to face these weeds that are growing all the time, to face Godzilla, you know, to face these afflictions that are arising. And I think one thing that I've learned and I've been practicing is like just trying to live a little bit more simply than I did before. I don't have to like commute to work. I do a lot of my work on Zoom now. I'm a teacher. We've been cooking more. And so like just taking the time to be with instead of like, okay, I got to get this done so I can make dinner and then eat and then, you know, take care of this and this, but like just enjoying that time of cooking more. Taking some time to connect with my friends and my family, even if it's on Zoom, like the way Ryokan would go into the villages. Also making time for practicing Zazen. There's a poem, here's another poem from a Chinese nun. And she writes, a single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. I love that. How does Zazen protect us? How does this practice protect us? That's a really interesting question. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse. I think we're seeing a lot of earth crumbling and heaven collapsing right now. But here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting. And a great kaleocosm, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but assembles on the tip of a feather. And a kaleocosm, I guess, is like thousands of worlds. So there's thousands of worlds just on the tip of a feather. I love this kind of poem where it's like this, you have this big thing, but it's down into this like really small space. And this reminded me that, you know, in our tradition, we think of, there's these bodhisattvas, sort of these great beings who embody compassion or wisdom. But there's also this sense that there are these great beings, but their activity is constantly arising all around us, and we just have to notice it. Like that sparrow flying through the forest. All these bodhisattvas are here all the time protecting us, and they're here all the time, people delivering our food, you know, making our food, driving us places in public transportation. Constantly, this bodhisattva activity is arising if we'd only just see it. And I certainly don't. I also think about like making time for practice, also just doing simple chores with full presence. Like Paul Disco's talk yesterday, he talked about as a body practice, like making in Asia, they learn things by in the situation. And so taking the time to practice with even just simple chores. So I've had this practice of sweeping every morning after I wake up. I just sweep our hallway. We have some pets, and so they drag in stuff or whatever. And it's just really interesting to take sweeping as a practice like this, because it's not like always this peaceful moment. Sometimes it's like, I don't want to do this, you know, or all of these things. I'm forgetting what I'm doing, but it's a great practice because I continue to come back to it. And over time I see like, well, this is another place where some of these difficult emotions arise, but also some wonderful things arise too. You know, I don't want to like not say that, you know, there's joy and there's great feelings of gratitude and connection that happen as well. Another practice that I've read about and have been doing is like finding a corner of your house, some little place, and just really keeping it clean every day, like your sink, or just a little, your desk or something, and just like tidying it up, not in like a obsessive way, but just like, oh, today I'm going to take care of this. And I've been learning like just taking care of little spaces like this really helps nourish my soul, really. Another thing is like that line from Song of the Grass Hut of taking a nap is like finding like there's like a different rhythm to the day now that I've found. There's, I'm finding it's more of like a natural rhythm almost like of just, oh, I'm hungry. I should eat. I'm not hungry. You have lunch, you know, and taking a nap sometimes, or going for a walk and just trying to find the natural rhythms of the days. And a lot of the nuns in this book, Daughters of Emptiness, there's a lot of mentions of like, they talk about this is a life of leisure, you know, living up here in the mountains. And I think it's leisure because it's, you know, there's not a lot of obligations on them. You know, it's not the leisure that we think of, that I think of as like watching more Netflix or something, you know, it's like leisure of like, just like being with whatever you're doing and just relaxing and taking walks. One of them talks about spending the day in a foolish way. I love that line. Like it'd be great. And then also just taking care of our bodies, as Shitu says, don't separate from the skin bag here and now. You know, taking care of our bodies is a really important part of this practice as well. There's one more poem too. I also think it's important to spend time with nature. You know, whatever that means, it could be like in my neighborhood there's some trees, or sometimes I go for walks in the woods around here. This is a poem from Zenryu. She says, I suddenly find myself upside down on level ground. When I pick myself up, I find there's nothing to say. If someone should ask me what this is all about, smiling, I'd point to the pure breeze and bright moon. And this is one of the first poems I chose from this collection, because I love this idea of like suddenly finding yourself upside down. And I think I'm picturing in one way, like, did she trip? You know, like, did she like just suddenly, did she slip and fall? But I think this is like a lot of like what I'm feeling right now. And I think in general, it's like you find yourself like totally topsy-turvy. Everything is upside down. And I think that's a good thing. I think sometimes it's a good thing to like be upside down and be look, you like, you see the sky, you know, you see things in a different way. And you sort of step out of like that, some of those normal, or I step out of my normal habitual ways of seeing things. And I like how when someone asks her some about it, she just smiles and points at the bright moon and the breeze. And I think that's kind of like this whole, all these poems talk about this, like just looking back to nature. And I know there's more symbolism to it than that, but I think also it's just nice to be in a pure breeze and the bright moon. So how do we practice with others when we're secluded? Some of these poems, you know, give a good glimpse into that. I'm sure you've all have your own answers to this. And the last poem I wanted to share is another one from Ryokan. And this really echoes back to, there's a little bit of Dogen there too. I might talk about that. There's goes back to that first poem. It kind of echoes that. He says, walking along, I followed the drifting stream to its source. So just like Wang Wei, following the stream back to its source. But reaching the headwaters left me stunned. That's when I realized that the true source isn't a particular place you can reach. So now, wherever my staff sets down, I just play in the currents, eddies, and swirls. And I just really like that poem because it totally turned the way I was thinking about that Wang Wei poem, you know, like sitting by the stream. It's like Ryokan is not walking along it. When he's like talks about setting his staff down, he's like ankle deep or knee deep in this stream, you know, and like just playing with the currents, eddies, and swirls, like playing with whatever's arising in that moment. And I think it could be pleasure, pain, it could be whatever difficult emotions, it could be joy, but whatever it is, it's just these eddies and swirls that are going around him and then they go away, you know, like just like the stream. And so just playing with that. And this idea that I don't have to go to some distant retreat. The source isn't a particular place we have to reach. It's here all around us. Like that bird flying through, we just have to notice it sometimes. So maybe I'll end really quickly with on that note. I love Dogen, so the essential way flows everywhere. How could it require practice or enlightenment? The essential teaching is fully available. How could effort be necessary? Furthermore, the entire mirror is free of dust. Why take steps to polish it? Nothing is separate from this very place. Why journey away? So thank you for listening. And I'd be happy to hear your reflection on these poems or any other ways that you have been finding to practice in this time. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Matt. And I'll just add as host, it looks like this, everyone is visible together on the screen. So if you're visible, you can just raise your hand in the anatomical way. And if not, you can use the participants button down at the bottom. When you click on participants at the bottom, you'll see a place to raise your hand. Should be easy to do with this group.
And I just, in the chat too, if you wanted to take a look at these poems on your own or whatever, I dropped that document I used in the chat as well. So. Yes.
Hi, Matt. Thank you so much. Your talk make my current life look so much more beautiful. I think it, I just like you, I tend to think of this as a like big session, and I'm going to work for 4 hours today. And I think I just set too many, day after day I set these goals, to be honest. I'm still doing these. I don't think they're particularly unuseful, but also it's quite tiresome in some ways, and feels unnatural. And while I'm just having this huge amount of time to observe nobody else but myself, is just like you, I found so many of my bad habits. For the first time, I thought, oh my God, I have to go to the Tuesday recovery session. Like, I really need to get away with all of these habits I have. Like, just binge watching these TV shows for like hours and hours, and just because I just don't want to face the life that I have. And I feel like I think part of me struggles a lot with that, but recently I feel like it is, just like you said, it is pretty important to be gentle in some ways. Mm-hmm. I learned this from my sister, actually. She recently got a small puppy and trying to train this little puppy. But this puppy, you know, like when puppies are really young, they run around, they bite everything. And the more you say to the puppy, like, stop, don't do it, the more the puppy is going to do it. And so I think I learned a lot about it. I don't think I'm too different from a puppy, to be honest. And so I find it just sometimes to just be gentle and soften, like really in a body or physical way, like just a lot better. And sometimes it's just let myself go and just watch the TV. Mm-hmm. And then at some point I find I just can't watch it for too long, actually. And so it's interesting. I think for the first time I actually start to understand when Suzuki talks about his teacher who says, I was like a tiger when I was young, but I was more like a cat. So wow, mm-hmm. I feel like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I think being a cat is not bad.
Yeah.
Kind of gentle.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you so much.
Yeah.
Very beautiful points.
Oh.
Funny cartoons. I like.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I think on the one hand, though, I think having distractions isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think sometimes, you know, they help us get through the day sometimes. And I think sometimes when I watch TV, it's like I really get into these stories and I get a lot out of them. But there's a point when it becomes, for me, like, when is it like enjoying myself? And like, when is it just like getting in the story? And when am I numbing something, you know? When am I using that to push something away? And on the one hand, it's also very helpful just to know that that's happening, you know, like to turn that light and say like, oh yeah, I'm doing this right now. I'm binge watching or whatever because I'm trying to like push something away. I think just to see that is super helpful for me. I think part of like our practice, we sit and face a wall, right? And I think the wall for a lot right now for me is like all of these, like I said, these habits. But I think what Bill Porter said about these hermits would go off to really face these teachings. And I think to really engage with them. And I think that's kind of like what I feel a lot of us are doing is like we're sitting and facing and engaging with these teachings in a way that we probably wouldn't have if we didn't have the situation. So. And I'm in a very privileged position. Like I have a nice apartment. I have all the food I want. I still have a job, you know? And so, but still, you know, thank you. Mike. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. The poems were lovely and kind of, I guess what I also needed to hear, to echo what Ching-Yi was also saying. Yeah, this has definitely been a time of, I have found that normally, like in the past, I've just like made my life just so busy and not in a bad way sometimes, but you know, seeing people and now it's just like, I have to face all this stuff or I'm finding that I'm facing all this stuff and that's, it's overwhelming and I kind of sometimes don't know. I end up judging myself pretty hard about how I handle it and Because it's all kind of new, I think. In the middle of the pandemic, we moved in together, and to also have to bless Wade for but to have to go through that process in front of someone, who we never lived together. So, so bless his heart for
and vice versa.
it's been so the poems that you shared were very. It's a nice reminder to kind of be kind, and you know, it's okay to slow down and to not have to have, you know, I find that I impose a schedule so much on my life, and I don't have to do that, you know, and there's a balance, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just wanted to say it resonated, and it was a good thing to hear. So thank you for sharing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think what you said is like having a balance. I mean, I still have to work too, but it's like finding like, oh, do I have to work that as much as I was before? No, because I actually don't have to, you know, there's like so much, a little bit more freedom in that and flexibility. And so, which is great, but then it's also a little bit terrifying. Like, oh, what am I going to do with this time now? Like, yeah, exactly. So, and I think like that whole, what you're saying, like of judging yourself, I find myself judging myself that I'm judging myself, you know? And so it's like extra judgment. So I don't know. It's like really, it's really interesting to watch that, you know? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, David.
Thank you so much, Matt, for that talk. And thank you for sharing those poems. I really feel nourished by that. It's one of the many things that amazes me about this tradition that I'm coming into is the how central and important literary texts and aesthetic beauty are. And that's super important to me, you know, and also to connect with the thing that you said about there still being hermits in China. Chinese culture and just the fragrance of Chinese culture is something that I've always loved, and I've had an opportunity to teach in China a couple of times. A course that I actually just finished teaching on Zoom, so I was here in Chicago and my students were in Beijing. But like the first or second year that I taught, we had gone to a museum for a field trip, and here was this, you know, high school, you know, jock stud straight boy out of China who had come to this class, and we're standing in front of a glass case, and we're looking at this monochrome, you know, very simple piece of ceramic, and he sighs and he says to me, "Isn't it exquisite? Wow, that is such a different culture that is open to exquisiteness." And I don't know, that openness to delicacy just like feels to me like at the center of our practice. And so you know, just thank you for letting us breathe the air of that tradition, and then connecting it to, you know, to compassion for myself and for others. I mean, so this year my marriage ended, my wife moved out, there's a disjunct between my sexuality and her gender, and it, you know, after 23 years that became an issue. And so I've done a lot of crying and praying to bodhisattvas for her to come back. It's like, no, that's over. I'm in a different, you know, today I talked to an agent, a real estate agent, about putting the condo on the market. It's like, no, I'm oriented toward the future. And it's like, this is my Zendo right here. And it's so remarkable because there's this dialectic. I'm alone and everybody's in a little square alone, except for my people, you know, who are together. But I'm alone and we're alone together. It's really remarkable. So, I mean, thank you. Thank you so much for that. That's not a question. It's just thank you.
Oh, well, thanks for sharing all that. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you've had some difficult months and...
Yeah, and I worked through it. Yeah.
And I was just thinking of what when you talked about the big jock guy looking at the exquisite and delicate. I think when I first came to Zen practice, I thought of it. It was kind of a macho thing a little bit. It's like, I'm going to sit and like a samurai, you know. And really, it's so tender, really. And I think someone has described the Soto practice, especially, as being warm, grandmotherly, and subtle. And I think that's kind of like that same thing. It's like, to the outside observer, it looks like we're like really like, but really there's like this warmth and tenderness there as well. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, I don't know. Diva.
Yes. Thank you. I really appreciated hearing the feminine side of the poems. So picturesque. I mean, you can tell that they were aware of everything around them. And I think that's good. And, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head, and so did, I believe, John or David, who's better known as the ancient dragon.
Mark, you're breaking up a little bit.
My main computer, everything went to hell this morning.
Oh, no.
I'm on a Chroma sitting in my front room, and thank goodness I spent time last week cleaning my front room. But I mean, it's interesting. I mean, each of us are kind of in a monastery, and we're all in our individual cells, but we get together periodically during the week in this communal fashion. And it's nice to know that the same struggles that they faced in the 1100s and 1600s are still the same struggles that we face in 2020. So give us a hope. So, and I'm sorry about breaking up. I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad I found you all. And thank you, Matt, for the poetry.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I think, you know, that's one thing I like about these poems is, like, they're so direct, and they're so, and they seem like they could have been written yesterday, you know, like they're so just, I really connect with them in like a really fresh way. And yeah, I think they're so picturesque because these people really inhabited these spaces, you know, they really, with their full bodies, they were in nature like that. And you mentioned, like, we're all in a monastery. And one thing I appreciate about our tradition is that there are so many different ways, kind of models for practice. There's like monks, there's hermits, there's, you know, people who are going out into the world and responding. And so I think even if we're not necessarily hermits or necessarily monks technically, I think we can still learn a lot and draw on these ways of practice that can really help us too. Ed.
Matt, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Thank you for calling on me, and I appreciate seeing you again. It's been some time, so I hope you're well. And thank you for doing the talk this evening. And I hesitated to make an offering because I'm not very good with feelings. I don't really have many, but I have been with this pandemic or whatever this thing is, rather than yourself to impose a greater sense of order on your residents, I probably have gone the opposite direction and I've let everything go. But I've also decided to study some of the elementary texts of Hinduism as it's referred to. And there's a line in the book, and I don't know how to pronounce it, the Bhagavad Gita, that I think in some ways I came to in response to your lovely talk. Chapter 13, number 29, it says, "He who sees that actions are performed exclusively by material nature and that the self is therefore not the agent sees." And so I take some knowledge in that, in the sense that all that's around us, including this social occasion of great impact, is of a material nature of which I have no agency. Nor maybe do I have the agency of response to it. So I just wanted to throw that in the mix a little bit. But thank you so much.
Yeah, interesting. I think that's probably for me, like one of the biggest things is like, everything is just so out of my, seems like it's so out of my control, you know, like there's nothing I can do about all this. And I mean, I guess really that's always the case. It's just more obvious now. I think I was in this delusion that I could control certain things that I could never have controlled before. I don't know. I maybe disagree though, that I think we can respond to, and I think that's what we can do is we can step away from some of these ways that we habitually just automatically respond. And we can find a way like that, taking that backward step helps us see, oh, I would usually do this, but actually I could do this or I could do this or I could do this, you know, and maybe I can find a way to respond in one of these ways. And that's one way that I think this practice has helped me is like, it sort of just opens up a range of responses or even just responding in the moment to it. Not that I have to sit there and think like, oh, should I do this or this or this? It's more like, I just know that I am able to respond to something too as well. But I don't know, maybe someone else has something they would want to say about that too, but that's just my initial. Taigen, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I thank you, Ed, for bringing that up. I think, especially now. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate your bringing in these poems of hermits and recluses from our tradition, from our Buddhist tradition. And it was a really wonderful selection. And in some ways, it's really fits for what's happening now. This is, you know, in some ways, this is an unparalleled situation in 2020. Mm-hmm. And thank you for reminding me of 2020 as a paradigm vision, which is long gone for me. But anyway,
yeah.
In some ways, this is such an unusual time this year. This pandemic, this virus, historically there have been the plague and the Spanish flu and all kinds of things. We also have this meeting, this 400 years pandemic of racism and how that's going and climate damage on top of it. And it's just all here this year and we don't know where it's going. Eventually, it's going somewhere and we don't know. But it's kind of amazing how, you know, the poems you read, Wang Wei and Chateau and those nuns' poems you read, and Ryokan Soto monk from the 1800s. These poems of people who were in some ways radically facing their aloneness, mm-hmm. which is what we are doing in a certain way, that things are beyond our control. And yet I think what you said, Matt, is right. We can respond in some way, but we don't know the outcome. Mm-hmm. We don't know, it's beyond our control. But, you know, as a number of you have said, we are here together in this strange way, mm-hmm. you know, with these little cells. Mm-hmm. it's really a strange situation. Mm-hmm. And Sangha is precious, and this is a strange way to be together. So mm-hmm. I just really appreciate you bringing these traditional recluse and hermit poems to this situation. It's really, I find it really helpful. So thank you very much. It's getting on in time for the evening. I don't know if there's a last comment or question or response anyone wants to share before we formally close. Feel free. Yes, Xingyu.
Maybe talking about hermit, I was just reminded there's this Chinese saying that says the small hermit is in the mountains, the middle hermits are in the market, the big hermits or the like superior hermits are are the politicians.
Yeah, and there's a modern poet who says it's so hard to be a saint in the city. But anyway, thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks.
So just to say, we'll chant the four Bodhisattva vows and then have announcements. And then for anyone who wants to stick around and just, hang out a little bit informally, you're welcome to do that.